Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Natalie Kalbakian of Loyola Law School's Ninth Circuit Appellate Clinic, under the supervision of attorneys Mary Christine Sangaila and Paula Mitchell, on behalf of the petitioner Mario Rajiv Flores Molina. I will discuss asylum and withholding for 8 minutes, and my colleague Tina Kwong will address cat protection and reopening for 7 minutes. We would each like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Mario Molina is a blacklisted political dissident from a country that, according to the U.S. State Department, is still governed by the Sandinista regime that maintains a policy of exile, jail, or death for its political opponents. After participating in the April 2018 protests, Mario received a series of escalating threats from government operatives, starting with online posts and a spray-painted message on his home, and finally materializing as an armed home invasion and a physical beating. Reversal of the BIA's denial of Mario's asylum and withholding claims is required because of the agency's failure to take into account key evidence on both past persecution and future persecution. For past persecution, the BIA, one, omitted the death threat contemporaneous with Mario's November 2018 beating at the hands of the government-sanctioned Sandinista youth. Two, characterized as a visit, a late-night raid by paramilitary for Mario at his home with drawn assault rifles on his roof while he hid from them in his own yard. And three, failed to consider that all of these events together compel a finding of past persecution. On the matter of well-founded fear of future persecution, Your Honors, the BIA ignored U.S. State Department and other human rights reports in favor of two discrete news reports that mentioned only examples of the government's limited release of political prisoners. The full record, including the comprehensive country reports and other recent news reports ignored by the agency, compels the conclusion that returnees like Mario are likely to continue to face persecution in the future.
Could I ask you a quick question? Who authored those articles?
The articles on which...
In the Post, I believe.
Yes.
Did the petitioner offer them?
No. Your Honor, are you referring to the two articles, the May 2019 articles on which, yes, they're authored by news agencies?
By who?
Reuters and Washington Post.
No, but who put them in evidence?
The DHS. May I proceed?
No, I'm sorry. I apologize. I didn't realize it would take so long.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. In its decision, the agency ignored much of the past conduct that amounted to persecution and was indisputably done at the hands of the government. The BIA denied the threats leading up to the beating Mario experienced were especially menacing, failing to properly characterize them as death threats. The final express death threat in November was a culmination of a series of other escalating threatening activity, from being included on an online blacklist of political dissidents with the caption, Chipotle awaits, the prison that the State Department reports referred to bullets to strikers being spray-painted on the walls of his home, and armed paramilitary members.
Counsel, you say that the BIA ignored this stuff, but you know, I'm looking at the BIA opinion decision here, and it says that, talks about Sandinista youth beating and threatening him, mm-hmm. spray-painting a threat on his residence,
mm-hmm.
And then it actually says he lost a tooth and cuts, bruises, and a scar. And so it seems to me that are you saying that they needed to have said that they beat him and made a death threat? As opposed, because it does say they threatened him, and they do cite to his brief, which I assume said that it was a death threat. It just seems like you're parsing it pretty thin in saying that they ignored things when you know, they have a list here of all the things you're talking about. They just don't. They don't go into all the detail you're saying.
Well,
they do omit a key piece of the incident, the discrete incident to which you referred to, which is the contemporaneous death threat. And this court has found that alone.
Counsel, do they omit it? I mean, they do say that they threatened him. They don't use the word death threat, but they say threatened him. So I don't understand that they omitted it. Is that right?
In the BIA's decision, when they discussed the beating, I believe that they've omitted that death threat from the consideration. So that's, they do refer to the threats leading up to the beating, but not the threat in tandem with the beating.
It says In November 2018, Sandista Youth beat and threatened him. And so it just doesn't say that they beat him and threatened him with death, I guess, but it says they threatened him, so they're referring to the threat, I think. And you're saying that the fact that they didn't mention death means they omitted that, even though they referred to
the threat. Well, that is a key omission because previously the BIA has characterized the threats leading up to this as not especially menacing, and a death threat is the most menacing type of threat that one could receive. And dropping that from the analysis when they have all these different details about the other incidents is erroneous. Because this court has found in itself that one incident of a death threat in conjunction with other forms of abuses, like a physical beating, amount to persecution in Smolniakova versus Gonzalez. So dropping that from the analysis is important. So it's not a matter of semantics that they didn't go into great detail, but the BIA is obligated to at least address things that this court has found alone amount to persecution.
You know if it's true that, because we can't reverse the BIA unless the record compels a different conclusion,
yes.
Right? And so you know if it's true that if you have a death threat and a beating, that it has to be persecution? You see what I'm saying? Like, I understand your point that, you know, there's a theory of ban of that the agency has a certain amount of discretion, and so within that ban, we don't overturn it. So I hear your point that a death threat and a beating could be persecution, but it has to be named a death threat and a beating. It has to be one of two things. Either they erred by not addressing the death threat, which I think is tough because they actually do say that he was threatened. They just don't use the word death. But or your argument could be that it has to be that if there's a death threat and a beating at the same time, then it has to be past persecution. Is that your argument, that it has to be?
Well, our argument is twofold, Your Honor. One, they downplay the threats leading up to this event when they're all, they are all death threats in nature and in context, and including the death threat against him during the beating. So that downplaying is, I guess, a key omission. And second, yes, our argument is that this combination of events has been found to amount to persecution by this court, affirmatively by this court in Smolniakova versus Gonzalez, where this court has stated that a death threat in conjunction with other forms of abuses requires a finding of past persecution. So that in mind, that omission, or at least downplaying the severity of the threats, is enough to find a remand or compel that the substantial evidence requires the opposite conclusion.
BIA just denied his claim on past persecution. Is that right? I mean, and future persecution.
Yes, they denied on both elements.
They didn't reach the other elements of asylum and withholding.
Right. They stopped their analysis for the most part at whether the incidents rose to the level of persecution.
Okay. Now you're going to share time with, I believe it's Ms. Kwong?
Yes, Your Honor. And for those reasons, the substantial evidence compels, the totality of experiences compel a remand.
Okay.
I'm going to adjust the camera a little bit. May it please the court, Tina Kwong of Loyola Law School's Ninth Circuit Appellate Clinic, on behalf of petitioner Mario Rajib Flores Molina. As my colleague mentioned, I am discussing Mario's motion to reopen an application for Convention Against Torture, or CAT relief. CAT prohibits the government from removing an individual to a country where it is more likely than not he would be tortured by government actors. Torture is more severe than persecution, but CAT relief is analytically separate from claims for asylum and withholding, and all evidence...
Let me ask you this. If we were to agree or conclude that there was error here and we granted relief on the first petition, this second petition would be moot, wouldn't it?
Sorry, which petition are you talking about, being the first and being the second?
Motion to reopen is the second one, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if petitioner were to prevail on the first petition that we just heard argument on,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
If he were to prevail on that, wouldn't this petition, the second petition, basically be moot?
Mm-hmm. So what we're requesting is this court remand to the BIA first to exercise its discretion to consider the second petition and whether to reopen so that Mr. Molina can be afforded the opportunity to pursue an adjustment of status with USCIS while seeing if they should stay the asylum withholding and CAT claims pending USCIS's adjudication of his application.
What is the status of that application? I mean, has it, I guess it's the I-30
mm-hmm.
that he wanted to file, but some time has gone by.
Mm-hmm.
We know what the status of it is right now.
Yeah, so we sent a letter to the court. Mr. Molina's green card was recently denied by USCIS, but he submitted timely motions to reopen and reconsider, so the denial is not final. The grounds for denial was that there was no showing of his lawful admission or parole into the United States, but Mr. Molina properly presented himself at a port of entry and has now been paroled, so in other words, released from detention, and the denial was on no other grounds.
So, counsel, I want to ask you about that. I feel like maybe you drew the short straw a little bit on having the motion to reopen part of this argument, because I'm a little disturbed at the very end of his opening brief. Petitioner's opening brief said there's nothing, his argument was to us that the only thing standing in my way of getting relief from USCIS was the agency not granting this motion to remand. And that's what you said in your opening brief. On page 66, you repeatedly said there's nothing that would disqualify him in his visa application from obtaining his change of status. And then you spent three pages of your opening brief saying there's nothing to disqualify him. But then you had the awkward, you did the best you could with the letter you sent us, but then you sent us a letter that said, well, actually, USCIS denied it, but we're gonna seek reopening. And they didn't deny it for the reason that you said that they would be the only reason they would deny it, which was mm-hmm. would be that he had a removal order that hadn't been stayed.
Mm-hmm.
Denied it because they had asked you for evidence about his lawful admission or parole, and you provided two documents, right? You provided the 2000. You didn't. You know, when somebody asks for evidence, usually they want evidence, like something showing that he was lawfully admitted or parole. What you provided was two documents that you thought supported that he had been lawfully admitted or paroled.
Mm-hmm.
2007 USCIS interoffice memorandum and an practice advisory.
Mm-hmm.
But those are basically arguments that he and the USCIS rejected those arguments essentially. But now he's been released.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem is it wasn't really true what you told us in the opening brief, I don't think, mm-hmm. right? When you said that there was nothing in his visa application materials to USCIS that would disqualify him. USCIS didn't agree with you. They disqualified him because they didn't think that he had been lawfully admitted or paroled, which is a requirement. So that's a problem. I mean, that's a little bit of a candor issue as far as, like, you told us there wasn't a problem. There was nothing in the way, but then there was. And you knew about that because two weeks before you filed your opening brief, you actually had gotten the request from USCIS asking for this evidence.
Mm-hmm. Well, Your Honor, we are working separately for this appeal than the immigration lawyers that are taking care of his USCIS application. And when we were going through the case, we didn't know about this. We all went through with the presumption that he was lawfully admitted or paroled. And even in the DHS's opposition to his motion to reopen, they said he was paroled. If you look at 2AR, pages 12 and 15, they explicitly say that he was paroled into the United States.
Okay, I'll ask about that. But in your point, now he has been. He was just released, I don't know, in December, right?
Mm-hmm. December.
Can you tell me why, and I'll ask the government's counsel if you don't know the answers, but why was he released? It has something to do with, is there some rule that they can only hold him for so long? Once there's a final order of removal, they can only hold him for so long. and then they have to release him? Is there some rule about that?
We are not entirely sure why he was released from parole, and it's unclear from the record before us why he was granted parole. I think the immigration court is in a better position to determine how this affects the motion to reopen and Mario's green card, which further supports remand.
I'll ask the government why he's been released. I mean, it seems like now he would be deemed parole maybe by USCIS, but but obviously they didn't think he was until he was actually released. So I'll ask the government about that.
Was he represented by counsel? He was not represented by counsel before the IJ, was he?
He was not represented before the IJ. So the denial by USCIS of the green card was on no other grounds, and the issue still remains that the BIA abused its discretion by denying Mario's motion to reopen for reasons contrary to law. The BIA's analysis misapplied or ignored the governing multi-factor framework required to assess continuances for adjustments of status set forth in Attorney General Opinion Matter of LABR. Under Matter of LABR...
Matter of LABR tells IJs, it provides IJs the framework by which they are supposed to consider motions for continuance. Is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So it doesn't, I mean, it doesn't on its face apply to the BIA. In fact, I don't, as I read Matter of LABR, it has like several things that would require fact-finding. Like you're supposed to look into, you know, things, but the BIA doesn't do fact-finding. So I don't see how the BIA was supposed. When you're asking for a motion to reopen at the BIA at the end of your proceedings, isn't that kind of different than asking for a continuance in the middle of your IJ proceeding?
The motion to reopen is for a continuance so that Mario can pursue adjustment of status with USCIS.
I know, but the difference is, you know, you're in the middle of your proceedings in front of the IJ, right? You're kind of you say, oh, I have a pending application. Can you please stay continue my proceedings? I mean, that's a matter of LABR. It says you look at these various things. But if you're all the way at the end of your proceedings and you're about ready to, you know, to send back and say final order of removal, you can remove the person. That's a different procedural posture than where matter LABR applies to, right?
Well, the BIA in its decision did cite matter of LABR, and they did cite what is required with the main
focus. That makes a certain amount of sense because you were asking them to send it back so that they would apply matter of LABR. But my point is, I'm not sure that does matter of LABR bind what the BIA's analysis should be. I understand they have to look at it to see what would happen if it went back down, right? Because then matter of LABR would bind the IJ. But does matter of LABR bind the BIA's analysis of a motion to reopen?
So matter of LABR binds the immigration court, and in the sense the BIA isn't doing fact-finding. It isn't looking at whether or not this affects the asylum withholding or CAT claims. It's looking at whether it affects the proceedings as a whole. And they did cite matter of LABR. They did not fully apply it, and they did not fully consider the secondary factors in applying it.
Okay, we let you go over your time, so I'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
All right, thank you, Alice.
All right, let's hear from the government.
May it please the court, Jeff Least appearing on behalf of the Attorney General. Substantial evidence supports the agency's denial of the petitioner's applications for asylum, withholding of removal, and CAT protection. As far as asylum and past persecution, the record does not compel the conclusion that the harm the petitioner suffered, threats, harassment, and one violent encounter over a period of several months at the hands of different actors, rose to the level of persecution. The petitioner argues that this
Isn't it clear that they were pretty much state actors?
There was a Facebook post that was threatening that was by an unknown person who the petitioner assumed was a government operative. There were the paramilitary and the police who came to his house, and there was a threatening.
I thought that the BIA acknowledged that Molina received threats from officials of the Nicaraguan government.
Yes, that's true, Your Honor. But they were not all the same individuals responsible. And the Sandinista youth movement, that was the petitioner's assumption that that's who was responsible for the actual beating and the threat.
That was what the BIA said, what I just read.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. The government's not contending that they're not all, you know, part of a larger conspiracy, but it is not the same individuals who are responsible for each
act. Well, who cares? Why is that relevant?
Because it's relevant because when you're looking at the harm cumulatively, you have to look at it in the context of what actually transpired. And so it's not the same thing where it's like the same individuals coming to harass him and to violently attack him. It's different people who are doing it.
Yeah, but
so that's why it's not necessary.
You're suggesting these are all somehow disconnected, independent actors?
It's not as simple as saying, you know, the same guy keeps coming around and harassing me. So they all could be linked to the government, but it's not the same individuals who are doing it.
Yeah, but that strikes me as being totally irrelevant from his standpoint about whether he's being persecuted by the government.
Well, I mean,
if I'm arrested and beaten by a police officer today, and then the next day is another police officer does that, I don't see the point that you're making.
I was just trying to illustrate that it was not kind of a clear cut case of the same individuals. The board did consider it.
I don't want to press it, but I just want to tell you that I don't think that's particularly relevant. So go ahead.
So counsel, I see Judge Corman's point. I didn't understand you to be saying, I mean, I think the BIA talks about threats from officials of the Nicaraguan government and such. So I didn't see this as like one of those cases that says the government's not involved or the government's not, or as I understood it, the BIA's decision on asylum, et cetera, is that it just doesn't rise to the level of past persecution. And I understood your opposing counsel to say, well, when you have a harm like he had, where he got beat up this one time, and you have a death threat, that the record therefore compels the conclusion of past persecution in the cited cases. Do you agree with that? If not, what are your cases where somebody was beat up and received a death threat and it was not past persecution?
Sure, Your Honor. The case Samad, we cited in our brief, it's 759 Federal Appendix at 636, dealt with that very issue. It dealt with death threats and a beating, and the majority of that panel found that, you know, while it is possible that death threats and a beating may constitute persecution, it does not necessarily compel the conclusion in every single case.
That was a memodisco, right?
What's that?
That was a memorandum disposition.
It was. It is an unpublished decision, Your Honor.
Not an opinion.
Correct, Your Honor. But I'm not aware of any cases that have found that it is like a per se persecution. It is certainly something that may be considered as court.
The one thing that's troubling me about this case is that you have to look at, as a counsel, Ms. Kabakian argued, is that you have to look at it cumulatively, don't you?
Correct, Your Honor. You look at it cumulatively.
And if you look at the he was forced to flee, the death threats, the beating, I don't see why this doesn't add up to past persecution.
Well, I mean, the court has found in a series of unpublished cases that similar harm, you know, where it involves threats and beatings and harassment by the government does not.
I'm not going to cite any memorandum dispositions for that proposition in whatever disposition we come up with here. But we have to look, what does our case law say? Our binding opinions.
Well, unfortunately, Your Honor, there's not a lot of published case law that discusses this, does not rise to the level of persecution. That's why a lot of the cases that you see the agency, and in fact this court citing to, are Gu and Haxa and Prasad, cases from about 15 years ago where it's held that, you know, detention, interrogation and beatings, harassment and one physical assault.
We've said, though, that death threats with other menacing activity essentially constitute, you know, is past persecution. Our case law is pretty clear about death threats.
But you're not, I mean, in Duran,
when you add other things to it, as Judge Van Dyke alluded to.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, it is possible for the court to come to that conclusion. The issue is whether or not the record compels that conclusion. And in this case, the board found that when you considered everything cumulatively, including the threats,
I read the board's decision, and they bookend the two words cumulatively, but they really, it's not to my mind cumulative, because they go through each one individually, and they understate things, and to a certain extent they ignore things. For example, with respect to a few people coming up to his house, what he testified to was that a truck, quote, full of cops and military paramilitary members wearing ski masks, bandanas, and military jackets and carrying AK-47 rifles arrived at his house and started looking at the door. And they asked for him by name, and they began to search the house. He described it as one of the worst days in his life. I don't see that description in the BIA's, what the BIA wrote. He saw, I believe, a neighbor or a friend of his shot and bled to death, who was also a protester, and whom we knew to be a protester. I mean, I find this. I hate to use the word shock to conscience, but it comes close to almost that. I mean, he's afraid to go to the hospital for his injuries because there are police and paramilitary at the entrance of the hospital. This is being decided in some sort of a vacuum. We're dealing with a military dictatorship that feels threatened by widespread demonstrations, and although demonstrations are peaceful, the government response is violent. I mean, I find it hard to believe that the government actually intends to deport this fellow, even if it wins this case. Why was he paroled? I suspect he was paroled because maybe somebody thought we're not going to send him back. Are we?
Your Honor, honestly, I don't know. I don't know what the basis for the parole was. I mean, the only documentation that I've received was what we got in the letter from opposing counsel last week. I can certainly, look into it and reach out to USCIS and provide that information, but I don't know what the basis for the parole was.
Can I ask you the question that I asked counsel just at the very beginning here? Mm-hmm. If the petitioner were to prevail on the past persecution issue and has to go back for further consideration of all the other elements of asylum and withholding, doesn't that effectively moot the second petition that's in front of us on the motion to reopen?
I think it would, essentially, Your Honor, if the case goes back.
Once it gets back to the agency, he could ask for it to be remanded to the IJ for consideration of
it. Well, I mean, a couple of things, Your Honor. If it gets remanded back to the board, that would, there would no longer be a final order of removal.
Right.
There's that aspect of it. He could then, at that point, I suppose, seek a remand to the extent that it would be necessary. I mean, given that the application has been denied, while it's not final because there is the motion to reconsider pending, I'm not sure that there's any real basis to send it all the way back to the immigration judge.
No.
For that purpose. But, I mean, if the case is already going back, then it kind of solves the issue the same way.
There were two, I just want to be clear in my own mind, the BIA dealt with solely with one issue, and that is whether or not he was subject to past persecution.
Correct.
They didn't deal with the other. They didn't address, I think, for understandable reasons, because it's obvious the other factors that would go into past persecution analysis. Do you concede that?
I mean,
those two factors.
The board did decide only based on past persecution for asylum and withholding, so it would have to consider them. I can't speak to how they would decide them if they did consider them. The CAT analysis is different, and the government would contend that the petitioner has not shown that he is eligible for CAT protection. But as far as asylum and withholding, the only basis for the board's decision was the past persecution and the well-founded fear, based off of no presumption of a well-founded fear of past persecution. So, I mean, it is possible that the case could go back and the board could find past persecution and then address, you know, find it, that the presumption of a well-founded fear was rebutted. But that, I mean, I'm just speculating as to what could possibly happen. But, it, you know, the board would have to conduct that analysis.
And what about, he had wanted to introduce a report, I think, from 2020.
Well, I mean,
that I take it you objected to it, but I'm troubled by the fact that he wasn't represented by counsel before the IJ, and what effect that has on the possibility of that being considered.
Well, if the case goes back to the agency, he could then seek to introduce additional evidence to the extent that would be relevant to his claims of harm. But this court can't consider evidence that was not before the agency. But the, I mean, the petitioner was not represented, but he did present evidence to the court. DHS also presented evidence. So, I mean, if it goes back to for further proceedings, then during those proceedings, he'll be able to presumably introduce additional evidence. If there are no further questions, the government requests that the petitions for review be denied.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Okay, back to the petitioner, Ms. Labakian.
Yes, Your Honor. In response to the government's statement, I would like to reiterate that cumulative analysis is required by the BIA. The BIA should not have divorced these events from one another, as Your Honor stated. And the BIA also cannot divorce this situation from the larger context of political.
So, counsel, Judge Corman, you know, he gave the government's attorney a little bit of a hard time for the BIA having sort of talked about each of the issues independently. It's sort of a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of thing going on here, right? Like, if the BIA, if doesn't talk about them all individually, then that means they didn't, you're saying they didn't take, in fact, they said threats but didn't use the word death, so that wasn't sufficient from your perspective. But that's the challenge with a cumulative analysis. I mean, it's hard to sort of document how you do a cumulative. They said they did a cumulative analysis. They talked about all the issues. How did they not do a cumulative analysis?
Well, by not drawing a through line between all these incidents that individuals in Nicaragua who are similarly situated have experienced, including political vandalism, raids, possibly being dragged to prison, and beaten up, by not drawing a through line, it seemed as though they were divorcing each incident from one another, and also downplayed the language.
You're saying they? What, I don't know what you mean by not drawing a. You say a through line?
Yes, a pattern in the persecution that was not found. That if they looked at the broader
context,
just
saying by not reaching the result that they cumulatively. I mean, they talked about all the issues.
Mm-hmm.
They said they did a cumulative analysis. They just reached a different conclusion. I think your answer is basically, well, because they didn't reach the conclusion that they didn't weigh things the way that we wanted to weigh, then that means they didn't look at them cumulatively.
Well, the next logical progression in the violence, Your Honor, is that he would be killed. The parting threat he was given was that we're going to kill you next time we find you. And so there's no indication like
I,
the...
But here what they... If I recall correctly...
I'm sorry,
this is the case that has the IJ looking at the article saying the most recent, you're saying there's a trend like this,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to keep going. And the IJ said, I think the IJ and the BIA said, yeah, there's a trend, but it seems to, which happens, right? Like sometimes things get worse, but throughout the history of mankind, they don't always get worse, right? Sometimes they, and the IJ said the latest stuff we've got is that things aren't necessarily getting worse. Now, I don't know what's happened since then. It's not in the record, and but I don't know that he necessarily erred in saying the latest thing shows that the regime is backing off a little bit.
Well, Your Honor, things do change, but this authoritarian government has not. and the 2018 report, as well as other reports.
I understand that's your position. I mean, I would be surprised if it wasn't. What I'm saying is...
I could address, Your Honor, the two news reports, I would like to address that for future persecution. Sorry for talking over you. I apologize.
I think we understand. I understand what the news reports are. I think the other judges understand the news report. My point is just that the IJ read them a certain way and said, I think that they're going a certain... That is some evidence in the record that is inconsistent with your theory that it's headed up and up direction and it just keeps on going.
Well, there's no indication in the full record that it is going up and up. There's no indication. The fact that after a year of pressure from the international community, there has been some limited release of prisoners does not speak to or address the petitioner's specific fear of being killed or seriously harmed upon return. The only news articles or information we have in the record is that returnees are either disappeared or face some other abuse upon return. So, in fact, if one steps back and doesn't just look at the two news reports that paint a rosy image, they would see that there's other forms of abuses not addressed, such as the criminal...
Wait a minute. Now, you said doesn't just look at the news reports. The news reports are some evidence in the record, right? Remember, it's substantial evidence to you. So, basically, you're saying they erred by relying on those...
Excessively relying on them. So we don't dispute that that's true, that there has been some improvement, but that doesn't mean that when you look at the broader context that there has been improvement for everyone. Some people got lucky, but in fact, in those news reports, the author concedes that the opposition and the government don't even agree on the number of...
I think I understand. What you're saying is that you read them differently, you read the evidence differently, but again, we have, our case law is pretty clear about that. At the end of the day, we don't get to like reweigh compared to the agency. I mean, I think at the end of the day, the agency's weighing has to be that record has to compel a different conclusion.
It's not only my argument, Your Honor. It's the argument that's compelled. It's the conclusion that's compelled by the cumulative record. In that this court has not relied upon two isolated news reports when this court has found that. Country reports are the most reliable source about foreign countries. So to completely ignore the trend of the Ortega government of lying to the international community about its resolve to de-escalate violence, that is an error in of itself that should have at least been acknowledged instead of just relying on the two 2019 reports when just 2 weeks before that, there was an acknowledgement that returnees that were deported, returnees like Mario, were disappeared. And so to not acknowledge that is a mistake, and that's why this should be remanded so that they can look at it.
Okay, Ms. Kalucki, thank you.
I just wanted to ask one more.
Go ahead, Judge Ward.
Question: The critical newspaper article is from the New York Post, and he's not represented by counsel. Who knows whether this is admissible, or even the New York Times, for that matter. I mean, they make mistakes all the time.
And that's why this court...
Here is to whether he had the competent assistance of counsel before the IJ when these so-called critical documents were even admitted, which may not have been admissible if he had a competent lawyer to argue with.
Yes, he was pro se before the IJ, Your Honor. And that's why, Your Honor, this court has heavily relied upon State Department reports as they're comprehensive instead of just talking about one form of abuse, which is holding political prisoners. There's a wide array of abuses that he could face that are not addressed in those news articles.
Okay.
Thank you for this opportunity to be heard, Your Honors.
Thank you. Ms. Quinn, I'll give you just 1 minute.
Your Honor. I'd just like to quickly address Judge Corman's question about the reports that were entered into evidence. So Mr. Molina did object to it, but he was told that the immigration judge told him that it would just be considered and the evidence would be weighed. So he did object to the articles himself.
I know, but this is a layperson making an objection. Without the benefit of argument to say this should never be admitted because who could rely on them?
Right. Again, he did try to object, and the court said it would properly weigh the evidence. However, the only thing the BIA cited was to the articles that were entered and not to the more probative country reports, such as the U.S. Department of State's country reports. That is also why we respectfully request that CAT be remanded, because in those reports contains evidence that political dissidents involved in the April 2018 protests, like Mario, are likely to be tortured by government actors for speaking out against the Ortega regime.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Kwong.
Thank you.
With that, we'd just like to thank express our appreciation to the Loyola Law School Clinical Program for participating in the court's pro bono program. Thank you very much. And we lost counsel for the government. Where's counsel for the government? There he is. Mr. Lisbon, thank you. Thanks to all of you. We appreciate the arguments this morning. The matter is submitted at this time.
Thank you so much.